Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, of the making of books, there is no end. How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, I do have another comment to read today. I am just full of comments. I actually now have to spread them out. So that's really great. But again, this really fits in with what we've been talking about the last program, and we'll be talking about some more on today's program. But here we go. It says, hello, Dennis Leap. I have enjoyed listening to your analysis and overview of Churchill's life, especially exploring how his youth and life before World War II prepared him for leadership on the greatest scale. I really appreciate that comment. That's really great. He goes on. Johnson's introduction is one of my favorite parts of the book because it shows that the generation educated in post-World War II British liberal socialist universities were compelled to change their opinions on the man after hearing his oratory and the force of his words. I would agree. That's a really powerful part of the Johnson book. The point that has stood out to me thus far is that Churchill is primarily a warrior. He was a politician, a writer, a painter, an orator, a bricklayer, expert polo player, but his prime mentality was always that of a soldier. World War I was one of the only modern wars in which Britain lacked an inspired prime minister. Asquith was more concerned with his mistress than the war effort, and the Dardanelles is a prime example of poor British leadership politically and militarily. And so this person sounds like they have a really good understanding of history. So there seems to have been two separate times when the operation, and they mean the Dardanelles, could have been successful. One, the Turkish artillery ran out of ammunition along the straits, and two, the British commander delayed marching on Istanbul for 3 days, allowing the Germans to come rushing to the rescue. It seems clear that God was not blessing the battle, and I do think, and he's talking about, he says, Mr. Gerald Fleury, and I think he's referring to the book as, Churchill the Watchman, wrote that this event helped humble Churchill for the future. It is great there is so much discussion on Churchill when the latest trend in revisionism is labeling him as a war criminal, racist, and a ruthless imperialist. The reality is much different, and just simply reading through Paul Johnson's biography brings to life the greatness of a man who stood head and shoulders above his contemporaries. Thanks for all of the effort you put into your shows, and I am looking forward to listening to all the future episodes. So I really do appreciate that comment, and I agree with it 100%, and that's just a great observation. So in the last program, we were talking about some of the background to what led to Winston Churchill's, let's say, downfall after the Dardanelles. And it is, you know, really, really, it's a real education for all of us to realize that there are just, we all have weaknesses and we all have to overcome our weaknesses. And Winston Churchill, here he is, a great statesman, also was a great warrior. But he had his weaknesses, and those weaknesses we do have to learn from. And as we get towards the end of this series, you know, there are lessons that we need to learn from Churchill's life. And one of them is just never give up. And that's the thing that is so amazing about Winston Churchill. You know, he had the problem with his dad. He never gave up. He had these problems once he got into politics. He never gave up. You know, he suffered, great defeats, but he never gave up. And that's just something for all of us to learn from. Now, at the very end of the program, I didn't have much time to finish it last time. But even after the Dardanelles, when they took Winston Churchill out of being first Lord of the Admiralty, they took him out of an a position that was really good for the country, he didn't give up. And, you know, he knew how bad the slaughter was, you know, out in the field. And here his wife had already had a couple children, and he asked if he could have a command, you know, out in the trenches. And so here he may have been down in the dumps, but that didn't stop him. He wanted to go out into the trenches, and he was just in his early 40s. And essentially, you know, Winston Churchill could talk about the horrors of World War I more than anyone else because he went and did that. And, you know, some people, when they suffer defeat, or maybe they lose political power, maybe they lose a position, you know, they just go ahead and they bury their head, or they go into seclusion. And, you know, there is a time coming when Winston did go more into seclusion, but he didn't dry up into a prune. But, you know, in many ways, he was preparing himself for his greatest challenge yet to come. But Churchill went out, asked for, you know, a command of the Grenadier Guards, and they were out in the trenches. And what you have to understand is he wasn't accepted there at first, or he wasn't very well received. And he went back into training, and, you know, so eventually they did give him the position of Lieutenant Colonel of the Royal Scots Fusiliers, and he served beside these men on the Western Front in the spring of 1916. And, you know, he really had to work hard to win them. But I'll tell you what, he was a courageous fighter. He fought alongside them, and the men that he fought beside, I mean, they have access to diaries, they have access to letters. I mean, can you imagine his poor wife? Here he is. He didn't have to do this, but he's out in these horrible trenches where they're up to their knees in mud. And so he went and he saw this war firsthand better than anybody else in command could see. So there's this interesting book called Churchill in the Trenches, and it's by Peter Apps. And I just wanted to read just a little bit of the introduction to introduce this program today. And let me just read this to you, and then I'll tell you what we're going to talk about today. So this is page 11 of this book, and I've only read this short introduction, so I think it's a pretty good book, but it's a very inexpensive book. I don't think you'd go wrong by buying it anyway. It says, by the time he arrived in Flanders at the end of 1915, Britain's future leader was at perhaps the most difficult point in his life. For most of the last 4 years, he had been First Lord of the Admiralty, the senior cabinet minister responsible for whole swathes of imperial maritime strategy. He had also found himself blamed for one of the greatest fiascos of the war so far, the Dardanelles. What Churchill had touted as a quick way to turn the course of the war through attacking Turkey had turned into a costly disaster. Churchill always maintained he did nothing wrong, that the strategy was a reasonable risk undermined by the colleagues who gave it inadequate resourcing. But he felt destroyed. "I am finished," he told his friends. 41 years old, he had already been a legend for almost 2 decades, first as a reporter, then in politics. Now he was placing himself alongside ordinary soldiers at the heart of the conflict. Everyone knew he might be killed. Not everyone believed he cared. Churchill's 5 months at the front were more than just an interlude. For a man born into the aristocracy in Blenheim Palace, who lived a life of prestige and luxury, they were perhaps his most extended sojourn amongst ordinary people. They were his most prolonged exposure to the grinding nature of everyday war. He had fought before, of course, in South Africa, Sudan, on the northwest frontier, but none of those experiences had been in any way typical. Rather than part of the conventional military chain of command, he had been a war correspondent. The trenches were different. Churchill, author of several dozen books chronicling not just his life but his ancestors and his era, barely wrote of his time in the trenches. His experiences were granted only a handful of photographs in the world crisis. his epic history of the Great War. Two essays written in the 1920s barely scratch the surface of his experience. But there is no shortage of detail. One of his officers, Andrew DeWar Gibb, the captain of the introduction, wrote his own account between the wars. There is the battalion's war diary, a smattering of other accounts from soldiers who were there. There are Churchill's own letters, mainly to his desperately worried wife, Clementine. They provide a fascinating portrait of a man trying to hold himself and his men together under sometimes hugely challenging conditions. Under his command, the battalion might never have fought a major battle, but it was under frequent shell fire, living in desperately grim conditions and suffering no shortage of dead and wounded. Maintaining grip and leadership under such circumstances, he told his officers, was as much an act as anything else. "War is a game played with a smile," he said repeatedly. "If you can't smile, grin. If you can't grin, stay out of the way until you can." He turned up in the trenches with a phenomenal array of extras, from hampers to wine to an improbably huge bathtub, but he shared and won the men over. Another junior officer, Jack McDavid, an initial skeptic, later said, "After a very brief period, he had accelerated the morale of officers and men to an almost unbelievable degree. It was sheer personality." His finest hour, of course, was yet to come. And so that's just a great introduction. And it tells you a lot about the man, Winston Churchill. And it is really, really quite amazing. Now, I want to just continue with where we left off last time, and let's talk a little bit more about what Winston Churchill experienced after the Dardanelles, but also I just want to let you know that he was, again, going to come into temporary favor. Again, he's just a master at, well, never giving up. So one thing, this is a fact of history, but still today you will hear people, especially in the press, that talk about the Dardanelles disaster. But remember this, in 1917, Churchill was cleared of blame for the Dardanelles disaster. And as Professor Rufus Fear says, yet the incident would continue to plague his reputation for many years. And that's the way the press can be, and that's the way the press is very vicious. And, you know, after World War One, you know, Britain really did enter into a pacifist mode, and they didn't want to hear about another war, but really they didn't have time to even hardly prepare for another war. And so after, you know, let's say 1917, David Lloyd George, his liberal government came back into power, and he wanted to bring Churchill back into the cabinet. And the thing is he still put Churchill in, well, really problematic posts. And so, in other words, David Lloyd George could have seemed like his friend, but still, Winston Churchill had such a presence. Everyone knew his military capabilities. A lot of these, the prime ministers that were over him knew that he understand war making better than they did, but they were always wary of him or leery of him, and they put him in positions. Well, if they wanted to get rid of him, they could set him up and they could dump him. Essentially, what happened. Now, in 1919, he became Minister for War and Air, and he had the really difficult part of demobilization, and there was all kinds of political things going on about that. In 1921, he became colonial secretary, and that brought with it the unenviable responsibility for handling problems in Ireland and the Middle East. I mean, those were both hotbeds, and we'll talk about this. Also, in the 1920s, Churchill warned against the rise of Soviet communism, and he really advocated an offensive strategy to deal with it. And but for all of his troubles, he was really accused of being a warmonger, and that was another thing that people wanted to hang on Churchill's back. And really, at this time after World War One, England, or you could say that, you know, the United Kingdom, they really entered into this pacifist posture. And of course, America was already in it. You know, they didn't want another war. And yet, Winston Churchill was the only one that had the sense and the insight to see that another one was coming. Now, again, he's accused of being a warmonger. Then in 1925, when the Liberal Party, fell apart, Churchill switched parties, went back to the Conservative Party, and of course that caused a lot of problems for him as well. But these lectures by Rufus Fears are really, really important. And it really does bring out things that Paul Johnson doesn't bring out. So here's the point. Even though a 19 and 17 investigative committee cleared Churchill of any blame on the Dardanelles, that came back over and over again. And basically, Rufus Fears says, it was just slander. It was just a slander campaign. Now, essentially what happened then is Lloyd George did bring Churchill back into government as the Minister of Munitions. And it was really wonderful, actually, for the Second World War, to get it ready for the Second World War, to have this happen. And everything that they made fun of him for in World War I, he got to get it into play. One of the big things is Winston Churchill was able to develop his concept of the armored tank. And remember, this was first conceived of when he was first Lord of the Admiralty, and they called it Churchill's Folly. And can you imagine winning World War II without having tanks? I mean, Germany was well into building all of these things. And so he was also able to develop air power that he had also wanted to start in World War I. And so the thing is, Churchill was getting that opportunity to really maybe become, the best minister for war and air. And, the thing is, Winston Churchill came up with things that were unthinkable by other men that were in the British military. And, he was really beginning to make a name for himself again. Now, even when he was assigned the job of demobilization of the armies after World War I, he really came up with the most unique strategy that no one else even thought of. And what he did is, they wanted to save money at the same time. And so what he did is, he brought home the troops that had spent the longest time in the war. And so instead of having to pay them, they brought them home, and that's what they wanted anyway. They wanted to be home with their families. And so he did a great job there. And it was very efficient what he came up with, and he was able to save the money. Now, Churchill really warned vigorously against communism. And essentially what he did was, right after World War I, Churchill wanted to take some of the troops, redeploy them to Russia to fight the Bolsheviks. Now, this was not a bad plan. The Bolsheviks were just slaughtering people. They were starving people. You talk about, the denial of human freedoms and human rights, the rights to property. This really bugged Winston Churchill when the Bolsheviks wouldn't let people own property. And the thing is, again, Winston Churchill was called a warmonger, and eventually it's everything in the government became so constrained again that they actually did nothing. And look what happened to Russia. Bolshevism took over. The real point with all of this is that the British Labour Party and then many of the British workers really came after Churchill, because the Bolsheviks always talked about, giving jobs to the people, taking away from the bourgeois people and giving it to the peasants. So so that they thought his attack on Bolshevism was attack on labor. That's not at all what was going on. So again, you know, you get that in the press, and the press takes over. You know, they were really against Churchill. When he was made colonial secretary, I mean, there were several things that Churchill did which was really great. I mean, one of his best known associates at that time was T.E. Lawrence, or Lawrence of Arabia. And our third book in this series is going to be about him. And, you know, they started to solve the Arabic problem. Also, Churchill, we have to understand at that time that he was a friend of the Zionist leaders. He believed in the idea of a Jewish state. There wouldn't be a Jewish state today if it wasn't for Winston Churchill. And so, but remember, his views again gained him enemies in the Middle Eastern countries. You know, people were not in favor of it, of Israel becoming a nation, and so again, he built his enemies there. And then also colonial secretary, there was the Irish problem, and it all had to do with home rule. There was a problem up there. He sent the troops to Ireland. And they were called the Black and Tans. They fought against the IRA terrorists. And, you know, the thing that really, got Churchill in trouble is he began to negotiate with the IRA, with Michael Collins. And that really it did not win him a lot of political favor in Ireland. But the compromise they have with, you know, North Ireland and the Republic of Ireland today is basically by Churchill. So the thing is even though these things, you know, he had so many people against him in these matters, still, you know, he was able to bring the parties together. And of course, when he and Michael Collins, they made some agreements about, you know, the North Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. I mean, when the Michael Collins signed the agreement, he told Winston Churchill, "I've signed my death warrant." And of course, he was killed not too long after that. So the thing is, back and forth there was the politics. I mean, the Winston Churchill did suffer these things, and then he was up, and then he was down, and then what Paul Johnson does show is that after some of these things, he was really on his way, you know, for favor. But then let me just go back to Johnson's book now. Let's go back to page 56. I want to read just a little bit here. It says, Churchill's service in the trenches served him well in both world wars because it enabled him to understand the views of ordinary soldiers and officers much better than Sir Douglas Haig, who never went near the trenches if he could help it. He thought his nature too tender and that experiencing horrors would undermine his ability to take hard decisions. He returned to London, exhilarated, eager for work, and to earn money to replace his ministerial salary, writing articles for the Sunday Pictorial and the Times. After demeaning attempts to cling on, Asquith was finally ousted in December 1916 and replaced by Lord George, who began to do many of the things he should have been automatic from the beginning of the war. He wanted to bring Churchill back, but the Tories and his coalition would not hear of it. After a key meeting with Lord George behind the Speaker's chair in May 1917, Churchill became his unofficial advisor on the war, though holding no office. Thus, master and servant were reunited, and Churchill, chastened by his experiences and aware of the risk the Prime Minister was taking to talk to him at all, was for a time silent and almost servile. His position, however, was helped by his alliance with a new friend, Max Aitken, Lord Beaverbrook, a Canadian financier who was rapidly building up one of the most successful newspapers empires in Britain. They became intimate friends, and Beaverbrook Press sang his praises. So the thing is, Churchill was coming back, and then it just so happened that this was only temporary. So it looks like we're out of time for today's program, but we'll continue this discussion next time. And what we'll do is we'll probably open up the next programs with our special guest on Churchill's political career, failures and successes, and that will really lead us directly to the miracle of Dunkirk. We are going to get to Dunkirk, believe me. Now, we're also quickly approaching the second book in this series, also by Paul Johnson. The book is titled George Washington, Founding Father. You can find this book on Amazon for $13 for Prime members. You can also find a used copy of the book for around $4 at abebooks.com. So, please write me any comments you may have to jbl at pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.